This is the Coconetics Podcast. Episode 44, recorded May 6, 2013. The early bird catches the worm. Hey, Tony.
Hi, Oliver.
Hey, long time no see.
Yeah, right. Nice to hear you.
Well, it's a long time since we talked. Actually, bad joke. I already made this joke in a previous podcast episode. We never talked. But as I said to our valued listeners, I'd like for this podcast to be more akin to a conversation between two old friends, as opposed to me being the interviewer and you being the interviewee. So, yeah, Tony, what are you up to these days?
Well, currently I'm working on quite a big project for iOS, Android, and also Windows Phone 8. It's kind of a guide for art objects in Switzerland.
One thing actually, I wanted to complain to you because you cannot set meetings that early. Now, I was thinking, oh, that's probably because you're in America and because of the time difference, it's late for you and early for me, but it turns out you're sitting in Switzerland.
That's right. I'm sitting in Lucerne, Switzerland. And
so it's early for you as well?
Not really. I'm used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I really appreciate the early hours because at that time I'm most productive.
Really?
Yes. And I mean, I work here in a bureau with other, I share the office with other people, and about 8 o'clock it gets quite noisy, so we have to talk early in the morning anyway. Mm-hmm. And in the evening, I mean, I have family, I have 3 kids, and they want to see me in the evening.
Yeah. Well, I also sit in an office with 2 other guys, and I have to agree, sometimes it gets noisy, but I cannot really flee from that because the noise is people asking me questions. So if I went there, they would be bothering me over Skype or something. So, let's give the listeners a little bit of background about you. I know you for years now, theoretically, but tell the people, how old are you, where are you, what do you do?
All right. Well, I'm 45 years old, so I'm almost a veteran in this industry. I have my own company called Next Software Studio. You spell it N3XD, and we do mainly iOS apps, also some Android and sometimes Windows Phone 8 apps. Mm-hmm. I founded this company 2011, and before I worked for a company which developed .NET, Microsoft .NET server applications for the publishing industry. In the 80s, that's when I started programming. I first came in touch with an Apple II. I programmed a little on Apple II with BASIC. Mm-hmm. And then later, about 1988, I touched my fingers first time with a Macintosh and wrote applications with Pascal, because that was the language Apple actually asked developers to do so.
So that was long before there was Objective-C?
Yeah, that was the preferred language for Apple or the Macintosh application development. You had development environment from Apple called MPW, which was a command line oriented interface. in contrast to the other GUI apps we had. And the other environment was ThinkPascal, which was also quite popular at this time.
Hey, we have something in common there. Actually, the first objective-oriented language that I was programming in was Turbo Pascal from Poland. I was making Windows apps.
Okay,
so I remember there was a summer when I was working as an intern at Siemens Vienna, and in Turbo Pascal I wrote a vacation management program where you would have like little boxes that you could tick for people when they are away. At that time, well, that must have been around 20 years ago, because I'm 37. I'm not yet as old as you. You're 45. But funny thing that we both started with Pascal. And where did you go from there?
Yeah, well, then in early in the 90s, we had quite a big project for the publishing industry here in Switzerland. And at that time, all publishers used Macintosh computers. And at the time, we decided to use C, because C became more popular also on the Mac platform. And also there was this C++ application framework called MacGap, which was also, first it was based on Object Pascal, and later on they converted it to C++. So at that time we stick to C and C++. Mm-hmm. And with C, or Objective-C, I came in touch at around 2001-2, when we had to publish a new release for our application running on Mac OS X. At that time, we decided to rewrite parts of our apps completely new for Mac OS X, and obviously we chose Objective-C at that time.
Was Objective-C introduced together with OS X?
Yes. Okay. It was, it came from Next. You surely know. Next was Next Computers developed Objective-C or used Objective-C late in the 80s. It was actually developed at a German university in 1984, I believe. And Next used this language for their operating system and for their frameworks. Hmm.
And so, to recap, OS 9 was not based on Next software, but OS 10 was. And Next was using Objective-C to program OS X.
Exactly.
And so that's why when Next bought Apple, as some people call it, actually it was the other way around, but arguably Next was the company that brought more value. Then Apple moved to Unix-based, BSD-based Mac OS X, and with that came Objective-C.
That's correct. I mean, the Mac OS X was mainly the next step operating system with the Macintosh look and feel. Mm. I mean, under the hood, it was really the next OS, next step. If you use the foundation classes like NSArray or whatever, NSString, that comes from next step. And even today, if you work with a free edition of NextStep, GNuStep, or whatever, I mean, they also brought all these classes over to this free OS. It's all based on Next. They were extremely innovative at that time. It was remarkable what they all did at that time, really.
Now, your company, you said you're doing mainly mobile development with a focus on iOS. Can you give some examples of apps you worked on? Or do you have maybe something current that you would like listeners to check out?
Well, yeah, of course, thanks. My very first iOS app I wrote was actually to solve a problem for myself. I had really old time mess with my password. But I wanted to have a strong and unique password for every website I wanted to register, not using the same password all the time. So I decided to write a deterministic password generator.
Okay, a password, I know that's something you type in with a login. Generator means it creates something like that, but what does deterministic mean?
It means when you first time use the app, you define a master password. Mm-hmm. It's your really top secret password. And once you want to log in, let's say you want to have a new Twitter account, you give the password generator a hint. Let's say you use twitter.com as hint. You type that in and then it generates a password, a unique strong password. And because the algorithm is deterministic, it means giving the algorithm the same input, it always generates the same output. Mm-hmm. So because you have your own secret, the master password, plus the hint, it can generate a new strong password.
What happens if you forget what hint you gave it?
That's something you have to agree for yourself. For myself, I always use the domain name of the website I want to register to.
So if I ever come to your office and find the post-it that you have on your monitor with your master password, I now am able to determine all the passwords of all the websites you're going to.
But you don't know my master password.
Yeah, well, it's on a post-it on your monitor, isn't it?
I'm not going to do that, of course. No, yeah, in this case you could. But the app has, I run it on my iPad at home and iPad in office and on the phones and the iPods and whatever. And so if my wife, for example, needs to register for a new site, she generates the same password as I would do on my phone, because we share the same master password. Mm-hmm. Or you have to say you have four categories. You can define four master passwords, and I use one to share passwords with my wife, for example, and with my kids.
Mm-hmm. Now, thinking about this, you don't store individual passwords, right?
No.
So in essence, because you have this on multiple devices, all of them are in sync, because there is nothing to sync.
That's the idea. You got the whole idea. That's exactly the whole idea behind it.
That's the optimal implementation of iCloud. Everything syncs perfectly because there is nothing to sync.
That's right.
Hey, that's awesome.
The algorithm actually is free. I put it on GitHub, so everyone can use it, maybe implement the desktop version or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wouldn't you be interested in making a Mac version?
No, I think I'll leave that to someone else if someone is interested. I did it for iPhone and that's it. Mm-hmm. Maybe I do one for Windows Phone 8, that's not decided. But the other OS and platforms I'll leave for someone else to do it. Mm-hmm. Someone did a website with it. And translated the code into JavaScript. Mm-hmm. But with a website, you have the problem that you have to send over the master password, and that's kind of risky. I mean, it's not, people usually don't trust it.
Mm-hmm. So that's the password app. Mm-hmm. Any other apps that you worked on?
Just recently, we released version 2 of Alpine Flower Finder. Mm-hmm. Alpine, it's a app with 150 alpine flowers. So if you go to the mountains to a track and see those beautiful flowers, it helps you to identify the flowers and to get more information. And that app was quite popular. It was mentioned in The Sun in the UK. It was mentioned in the Frankfurter Allgemeine in Germany, and of course here in Switzerland also. Mm-hmm. It was a contract work for a photographer. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And also another app for Zurich. It's actually more a map where you find all the animals, mm-hmm. get some background information about the animals, and also with tours. For example, it's raining, and then you can take the rainy tour. So you more stick to buildings like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the way, as you mentioned, we haven't talked for a while. What are you doing right now?
Oh, thanks for asking. In the past week or past couple of weeks, I've been really busy with my DT Richtext editor. You know that's this commercial component I'm selling that's based on DT Core Text, which again is an open source component that can parse HTML, create attributed strings out of it, can actually create HTML out of attributed strings, and all of that is open source. And based on this, I add selection, the magnifying glass for the selection that you need, and many other things that you need for editing. And I'm gearing up for version 1.5 release, which is a really big one. I switched to Git a while back, and mm-hmm. There are multiple people working on this at the moment together with me. People who are using the component in their own app themselves and contributing additions and improvements and bug fixes and so on. So that's going to be a really exciting release when I actually can get it out of the door. Also there, I have two modes of operation. One is that people actually buy the component, and that gives me a little bit of funding to continue development there. But I'm also increasing the frequency of people actually wanting a specific enhancement, like for this recent version, two people sponsored the addition of list support. So if you want to bulleted or numbered lists, version 1.5 can also now deal with these. And there were two people who sponsored that. So I'm accepting that people who really need a specific feature pay a little bit of money for my time to actually go and implement this. And I'm putting this into the component, so everybody else who has access to the source code, being a customer, can benefit from these. And that's working really good, really well. Okay. The other thing, as a side project, I'm also open source working on auto ingest for Mac, which is a while ago, actually a year ago, Apple released a Java tool for downloading sales reports from their website that was called Auto Ingest, and I decompiled it. It was a Java app. I decompiled it and rewrote it in Objective-C, and the result of that is on GitHub. It's my DT ITC report downloader component. Initially, it was able to download daily and weekly sales report, and in March Apple added monthly, yearly sales reports, opt-in reports, and newsstand reports. So that's grown a bit. I had to do some additions there, And since I don't have any opt-in and newsstand reports myself, I don't have any newsstand apps, I needed to have a few people send me their test results if they are able to download reports. And that worked well. So we are going to add these to a future version. And this app ingest for Mac is basically a small Apple icon that runs in the status bar, and you set it up with your Apple ID and the vendor ID, and you choose which reports to download, and then it downloads these report files to a location on your hard disk. And what you can do, for example, is you can download them to Dropbox, and then you can have the same app running on a different Mac. Say you have one instance running on your notebook and another running on your Mac Mini server, and they will see the files that the other instance downloaded to Dropbox, because Dropbox syncs them, so it will only download them once. And the idea there is that independently from third-party services who would need to have your iTunes credentials, you basically get to keep these report files, whatever you do with them later on. At least you have them. Yeah, so that's the idea. And there are at the moment like three people contributing changes there, and working together to make this nicer. Like we already have the second iteration of the icon. The first one was basically a set of PNGs, and the second one is now switched to being vector based using PDFs. So there are like I think 50 PDF small PDFs in the app that it renders for the exact resolution needed on the Mac, and I'm really happy with that. It's a really nice one. So if anybody who's getting sales reports because he has apps on the App Store, I would encourage to look at this project. You can either compile it yourself, just download, build and run, or another possibility, since the last version, I like to do releases for this on Fridays. So the last version 0.3 also has a build available that I signed with developer ID, and that's distributed via Sparkle. So when I do the next update, you will automatically get that via Sparkle. So
interesting.
That's that. Yeah, and of course the other big topic of late was WWDC.
Ah, I see. Just coming back to the to your to source code projects. How's the workflow? I've never worked with. I was never part of a work of a open source project. Mm-hmm. How do you handle it? Are there any extra thing you have to take into account, or?
I personally don't have kind of the rule book on this, but I can just say what in my own experience how I'm doing it. I have two platforms that I have source code on. One is GitHub for my open source things, and for the private source repositories, I would have wanted GitHub for enterprise, but I can't afford the $5,000 that costs me. So instead, I chose GitLab, which looks really similar to GitHub. And both of these systems have per project a page of issues that you can tag and that you can assign to milestones. So what I like to do is when I encounter an issue or think of an enhancement that's possible, I just put that on the list of issues first. You can assign these issues to the contributors of the project, which are basically in GitLab, they are called developers, and on GitHub, they are called contributors. And so, for example, I would assign a specific issue that I think I'm going to work on, say Sparkle integration, I assign to myself, and I assign to a milestone that I think would want to release this on. And okay. So while you work off the issues, once you close the issue, you have like a progress bar next to the milestone. And once all issues of the milestone are complete, you basically know, okay, I can release this version now. And in order to not get into each other's hair, there's a system that you can find on the internet. It's called a successful Git branching model, which basically means the master branch is always stable and always has the latest released and tagged version.
Mm-hmm.
You have a develop branch, where basically you merge into the feature branches you do. So say I'm implementing Sparkle, so I branch of develop. On this branch, I make all the changes necessary for Sparkle to work. And once I'm satisfied with that, I merge it back into develop. And
oh, I see, yes. Other makes people, sense. Yeah.
For example, my friend Felipe worked on some auto-arrangement feature for auto-ingest, where it arranges the report files into a folder structure based on the type of the report. And this development he was doing on his own feature branch, always prefixed with the name. So his shorthand is FCY / and then the name of the feature he's working on. And just, I think, 2 days ago, he sent the pull request. And the pull request means he requests that I pull the result of his work on this feature branch into develop.
Okay.
I see. There you have sort of a possibility to code review and make sure that these features don't break anything.
Mm.
And so that's what's going on all the time. People doing something on a branch for themselves, and when they feel they're ready, I merge it back into develop. Then for the actual release, it's basically making a quick branch of develop that I call, say, release 1.3, where I set the app version and maybe a few other things that are related to the release. And then I merge this release branch into master,
mm-hmm.
and there I tag that. So you have several tags on the project that basically point towards locations on the master branch where the path came back from develop to master.
Okay.
So if you wanted version 0.3.0, there's a tag, you can go to that directly. Or next Friday, when there will be 0.4.0, then that will also be a tag on master. And on Friday, I spent the whole day working on our continuous integration server so that I can get this Sparkle distribution set up for the most part automated. The only thing that's missing there for me is that I need to get the build number into the CF bundle version. At the moment, I still have to set it manually, but I'm sure today I can find a quick way to get the build number, which would be like 35 or so, from the build server into the machine readable. It's called CF bundle version. That's supposed to be the version number that's machine readable. And then there's some people call it marketing version. In the info plist, it's called CF short version display string or something like that. And that would be like what the user sees, 0.3.0. So
okay.
the whole version number you see is comprised of the marketing version 0.3 bracket and then the build number bracket closed. And so yeah, that's what I hope to be automating, that in the end I don't need to do anything anymore, but my Jenkins server would watch the master branch. And since nothing's happening usually in the master branch, it wouldn't do anything. But as soon as I do this merge from the release / develop branch into master, then it would see, there was a change, and it would automatically build the master branch and push this out to the download server. And so people would, everybody who's using the Sparkle-enabled version of AutoIngest would get there's an update available.
I see. Cool.
Yeah. That's this. So, I wouldn't say there's anything different than working with a team on something. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I learned is you have to try to have independent parts of work. So, you get into trouble if two people are working on exactly the same files, because then you start to get conflicts where you then have to resolve on the merge. These three lines I want, these three lines I have to delete. If you ever dealt with a merge conflict, I don't like these.
Yeah, I see. And yeah, I understand. So
also one thing that's tedious is if both people add files to the project. Because then you have to manually merge the project.pbx proj, which is a XML file, a plist. And fortunately, I found that if you have a graphical tool like, for example, Kaleidoscope, which I'm using now as a graphic comparison, graphic is the wrong word, as a
nice alternative to your command line. Yeah.
Yeah. Kaleidoscope has Git integration. So there's a menu option in the preferences where you say enable integration. And then if you have to diff something, you can write Git diff tool, and then it will open Kaleidoscope with the diff. And if you have to merge something, you can write Git merge tool, and then it will open Kaleidoscope in merge mode, and you can specifically say, okay, I want the left side, here I want the right side. That's really fabulous.
Oh, I found myself, or in our company, we use Source3 as mm-hmm. the graphical alternative to a command line-based Git. Mm-hmm. It's also a very nice tool, I have to say. And we use Bitbucket for our internal project. Mm-hmm.
I'll be sure to make a note here to put this on the show notes as well.
Yeah, it's also free, and it's obviously quite similar to the tools or to GitHub and the other system you mentioned, GitLab. Mm-hmm. It has also this issue tracker. We have a wiki for each project and things like that.
Now, Bitbucket, isn't that owned by Atlassian?
Correct.
So don't they want you to use Jira for the issues?
At least not yet. Or I mean, sure, they're happy if you do that, but you can use this very simple issue tracking system just built on the Bitbucket platform. So far it was just enough for us.
So you don't need the complex management of issues that Jira provides. You're happy with the simple issue
tracker. Right. Yes.
Yeah. I prefer it myself. It's a bit more social, I think. If you have issues, it's a little bit like a email conversation that goes on, and especially with GitHub, for example, they have email integration. So if somebody comments on an issue of yours, you can just respond to the email notification, and GitHub will then paste your response into this thread, And it feels more like you have a conversation going on with the people. Whereas with other issue trackers, we have Mantis BT for the kind of really formal, strict issue tracking. There you feel a little more disconnected from the people and the issues. Some people, I know people who feel that that's a good thing, and it gives them a feeling of more control by having everything strict and labeled, and you have different states. You have a state, it's open, it's confirmed, it's will fix, will not fix, it's implemented but not released yet. The people who need these kind of different states, whereas with the basic issue tracking that you get with GitHub, GitLab, and obviously also Bitbucket, you just have a ticket can or an issue can be open or closed, and then it can have different tags. Yeah, you can say that's a feature, that's a known issue, meaning we won't fix it immediately. It's a bug that we have to fix. I feel a little bit freer if I work with simple issue tracking as opposed to a real formal strict thing like Jira or Mantis.
What a really benefit is, I usually have also, or I give our customers also account on GitHub for a certain project. Mm-hmm. And the customers, contractors themselves can create new issues or upload, let's say, for example, graphics or whatever. And it really gives a very good workflow between customer and us.
Yeah, well, I hate it when customers send me an email with 5 megabytes.
Yes.
Here are the graphics. You can,
right,
can add them to the repository. When they could also just, if they knew a little bit of Git, add them to the repository and push them directly.
Yes. Yeah. And that's why a simple issue management, a simple portal where you can upload data and see what's the current state? I mean, that really benefits the workflow with customers. I mean, you can't give a complex version tracking system to a customer. That's just impossible. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, let's chat a bit about WWDC.
Yes,
so
sure.
Are you going?
No, I'm not going.
Oh, why?
Well, I just don't have the time right now, and I think it's quite tedious to get a ticket, as I what I heard of.
You can say that aloud. Go on in 70 seconds.
Yeah, I heard it's really it's kind of difficult to get a ticket, and I didn't want to. I just don't have the time and the nerve to go through that ordeal right now. Mm. I've been at WWDC, I think, 5 or 6 times, but it was in 1998, the first time, when Steve Jobs just came back to Apple. Mm-hmm. And I kept going to WWDC the next few years, yeah. Mm-hmm. My last one was in 2002 or 3, I don't remember exactly.
So you actually don't know how much of a busy place it's become, or how big it's going on, or where they also having like 5,000 people at these times, or was it smaller?
Yeah, it was smaller at that time. It was held in San Jose.
Oh, really?
At the convention center.
It wasn't in Moscone Center all the time.
No, it was in San Jose. And at the time, I think we were around 1,800 to 2,200 people.
Oh, comfortable.
And after a few years, you really, you know, you don't know everyone, but you know, I've seen that guy before, or this one, or you sort of get know to each other.
Hey, Tony, tell me one thing. I recently kind of got a bit into how can we engineers and tech people get more women into programming and mm-hmm. and kind of increase the quota of women. And there's an unofficial statistic from WWDC 2012. An Apple employee, when asked how many women there are, responded unofficially, as I said, and probably not authorized to say that and everything, that there were 3.5% women.
Okay.
Now, I wrote a blog post about that just yesterday or 2 days ago. And I'm making a Twitter list with people who are going, and so far I've collected over 300 people. And of these, my personal statistic is 1.8%. So it seems to be that the attendance of female developers at WWDC is in the low single-digit range. So I'd say 3%, maybe 4% tops. Now, and that's what I want to ask you about. Somebody who reads my blog, as everybody should, responded that in the times before Apple bought Next, and maybe even at the time when you went to WWDC, there was a much higher ratio of women at WWDC. Can you remember where there more than 3%?
It's hard to say.
He said something like 40%.
Well, those early days, the WWDC was also, at least the first day was also for the journalists. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of journalists and magazine writers and other interesting people, because it was never fully booked and everyone could come to WWDC. And I think the first time it could be there were much more women. Mm-hmm. But I think the rest of the week it was just about the same as nowadays.
Ah, you think so?
You know, in 1998 and the following years, the first day we had always this big announcements. Mm-hmm. There was, new hardware, new OS, just what the company is heading to. Was all released on that day, on the first day. And I think the first day, half of the people were journalists. Mm-hmm. I don't believe there were more women programming, developing software than nowadays.
Okay.
I don't think so. Mm.
Well, regardless, I'm still thinking it's sad that there are so few. So that's one of the reasons why I've got this young cousin Julia Grill, and she's really into technology and into writing about it. So I helped her set up a blog. We called it Tech Cricket, mm-hmm. And she plans to blog and communicate about situations where companies do something that's maybe a little bit sexist, or on the other hand, the positive, some companies that are really doing a good job in marketing their technology to the female audience. And the name Tech Cricket, we thought of, really is a kind of a cute story. Julia Grill, if you add an E in German, means Grille, which in English mm-hmm. means cricket. Often she's been called Grille as a kind of a nickname or a little bit of derisiveness there. So she said she wanted to basically own this term and convert it into something positive. So I suggested, okay, let's call it cricket. But then we looked up cricket, and it turns out that there is no female form of cricket. Cricket is always male. So in French, you can take E-T-T-E and add it to anything and make a female form. So basically, we invented the female form of cricket, which is cricket.
And funny.
And that's how the name came to be. So we are basically inventing the female form of something that's predominantly or exclusively male, just like the topics of tech cricket should be inventing or finding the female form of how technology is communicated about and towards women. So I'd invite people who have some encounter, if they find on Twitter or on the internet some example of a company that does an exceptionally well job of communicating to women, or an exceptionally poor job doing that, then to drop an email to Julia that she can look at that and blog about it.
I see. Okay.
So,
cool.
Yeah, I am going to WWDC, just to clarify. It's my third time. I started in 2010. Okay. Which year do we have now? 2013. So it was 2011. Yeah. At my first year, and I was lucky there because I got sponsored.
Mm-hmm.
The second year I had to pay for myself, and this is now the third year, and I was actually planning to, for a year now I have got an employee that I wanted to bring to WWDC as well, but yeah, there was this ticket cock up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
how quickly were they sold out this year? I didn't follow.
There's an unofficial statement of something like 70 seconds. and I'm a little bit grumpy about that because Apple specifically stated this year that you can use the same credit card 5 times to buy a ticket, but each team member must log in individually and make the purchase himself. So you have to imagine Stefan and me sitting in the office, both Macs lit. Stefan with a post-it that has my credit card details, I with my credit card in front of me, and we check the site, reload. Okay, I get the green button, or was it blue, to get a ticket, and he didn't get it right away. So I was able to go in, make the order, and then there's this quantity box where it says, I want to buy X tickets. And for a moment I thought, well, maybe I should put 2 in there. But I don't want to risk anything. I don't want to have the system then tell me, no, you cannot get 2. So I left it at 1, made the purchase, paid, no problem. All the while, Stefan wasn't even able to complete the second step, which after saying that you wanted a ticket, you needed to log in with your account. And apparently, Apple's LDAP server, which authenticates the Apple IDs, went down under the load. And so Stefan wasn't able to log in. So in the end, I ended up with a ticket and he didn't get any. Now, there were a couple of people who were lucky, because if you already had logged in, that meant the system had given you a sufficiently low number in the queue. Yeah. Like there were about 5,000 numbers that you would get assigned. And once you logged in, then the system would know, okay, there's number 3,000 and that's his name. Did he go through with the purchase? Yes, okay, everything is fine. And if not, then Apple developer support would call these people and actually tell them over the phone, we see you have reserved the ticket but weren't able to go through. Do you still want it? And then most people would say, yeah, hell yes, I still want it. Yeah. So there were, I estimate, maybe 1,000 or so extra people who after the initial frenzy got a phone call from Apple developer support, and they were able to get a ticket. But unfortunately, because my friend and employee Stefan didn't get to log in. He was not on the list and we didn't get a phone call. So long story short, I'm still bringing him because I wanted to give this to him as a kind of goodie bonus because he lasted the first year with my company. But he will go to Alt WWDC, which is organized by the guys from Amsterdam. And it's it's really close to Moscone Center, so they will be having talks and famous guests, and I think he's going to have a good time there as well, while I am mingling with the guys inside the Moscone Center. So yeah, well, that's a consolidation there, but it's really sad that it came to this, and there's really no way how you can modify WWDC for it not to be essentially dead.
Yeah, I mean, they should run a conference here in Europe, but maybe in Asia too, like Microsoft does. As you know, I worked on the Microsoft stack the last 7-8 years. And I usually attended TechCat, that's the Microsoft version of WWDC. And here in Europe, it was usually held, or it was 3 times held in Barcelona, 3 times in Berlin, and I think this year it's in Madrid. We were usually around 7,000 to 8,000 people just here in Europe. And they had about, I think they had, they held 10 or 12 conferences all over the world.
Well, what Apple is doing to kind of bring a bit of the feeling of WWDC around the world is, last year they didn't do that, but the year before they did, and they call it the Tech Talks Roadshow. They are in a couple of cities or around the world, where there's a one-day mini WWDC. And when they did that, I also went there. I went to the London Tech Talk. And there, after the Tech Talk, there was a reception with people getting snacks and drinks. And I took the opportunity to speak to John Galenzi, who's the chief evangelist. And basically, I've been suggesting for the past couple of years that Apple should do a Euro WWDC, at least.
Yeah, completely agree. I think it shouldn't be a short form or whatever. It should be just exactly the same conference. And really, Microsoft does a good job in this regard.
Yeah, but you know that the big difference between Microsoft and Apple is that Apple does not have a large staff dedicated to training.
Yeah, that's right.
And so WWDC is basically run and being presented on by Apple engineers for the most part. So that's many people say this makes the charm of WWDC.
Yeah, but that's the same with Microsoft. At least half of the sessions are also held by engineers. I mean, sometimes that's good, sometimes bad, because you can stumble into a person who never did a talk before. And but well, I mean, the company is, of course, is much, at least in regards to employees, is much bigger. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, the other reason that John Galenzi told me they can't do that is cost. Where nowadays with Apple's big pile of cash, I have to silently giggle that Apple has a problem with cost, and the third argument that I heard was they cannot spare the developers for that long. But I'm thinking, if you do a Tech Talk roadshow, which is, I think, was it 8 cities or so, where you have to arrive the day before, set up, do a full day, and then you lose another day for training, for traveling back. if you did a couple of days in a row, say 3 days or 4 days, I mean, WWDC is really just 3 days, because you don't have much going on the first day with the keynote, and you don't have much going on Friday, because many people already leave it at midday. So essentially, if you did 3 days and you did them somewhere central in Europe and maybe somewhere Pacific Rim, Asia, I think they would actually have less traveling, less cost, and still be able to basically reuse the talks and presentations they made, and they could bring a couple of engineers and do some labs as they also did on the tech talk. So I'm a big fan of this idea, but unfortunately I don't see Apple being that flexible.
What really impressed me when I was working for Microsoft with Microsoft stuff was they have this so-called Microsoft most valuable person or so.
Most valued professional.
Yeah, right. And a lot of sessions were held by those local people. I mean, that was a good way to, make the conference a little cheaper.
Well, I'm thinking it would be awesome if there are many people in the Apple ecosystem who feel they are born to train and give talks and basically pass on their knowledge. I would be one of the first volunteering for such a program, because if you follow my blog, I write how-to articles all the time, and I love to be passing on development knowledge. But as Apple is now organized, they have a very secretive culture. They are run like a startup, they say, and so they don't have it in their genes to open up and take other people almost like a peer. So you are like you belong to us. You are a valued professional. It's like to Apple, the only professionals they value are the employees of Apple.
Yeah, I mean, at least it would really help
would,
Apple.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be a great thing to do. Anyway.
Yeah.
I've never been, but I frequently listen also to or see what NS Conference does, and I think I'm probably gonna join one of these conferences.
I've been to NS Conference last year, and I loved it, because what they do is besides they do have some presentations, but they also do labs. Like there was one lab that I went to with Markus Sara. You might have heard about him. He's the de facto guru in core data, and he explained to us some concepts like working with multiple contexts on background threads and so on. That was really, really amazing. And the other thing that's a big strength of NS Conference is they make sure that there are ample opportunities for people to mingle and network.
Yeah,
because that's like, I'd say 30 to 40% of the value of the conference. Because NS Conference also makes available the videos. You can buy them for, I think, $150 or something. But conferences, it seems, are a place, especially for the more advanced developers, to mingle and meet international friends that you might have chatted with or committed code to their open source component, but there you have a opportunity to actually rub shoulders with them. And
yeah, right. I mean, nowadays that's always the case. I mean, the information, you get the information anyway. You can watch the videos later or after the conference. I mean, just going for the sessions, it's usually not really the reason to go to a conference, but for doing just what you mentioned, talking with people, make friends and get into touch with others.
So what do you think about this trend that on the one hand, Apple knows they have a problem, so what they do to kind of calm the people who just want the content of the sessions and want to know what news is coming to the platform, they make the conference videos available already during the running of the conference. So in the worst case, you might be 2 or 3 days later informed than people actually attending. So that's one strategy that Apple does. The other being that they said, okay, you missed that, but you have a second chance going to the tech talks. And I think what they'll do is if you got a ticket for WWDC, you probably won't be allowed to get a ticket for the tech talks, to make that fair. All around WWDC, there are alternative conferences popping up. And even last year, I saw many people say, well, I didn't get a ticket. There was this thing about the timing issue where people on the West Coast didn't get a ticket because it was too early in the morning. And so people came to San Francisco anyway to just kind of mingle with the other developers at the parties. So it seems to me one solution to the problem might be to not do anything, but communicate the videos more often, do slightly more tech talks, and then let the community do the rest. Like, everybody's coming to San Francisco, everybody's meeting anyway, so what does Apple need to do?
I don't know how much Apple supports those third-party conferences.
Well, they don't. But it's a fact.
So they should, in this case, I guess.
Well, maybe they could kind of lend out some developers who are having a firm foot in the community. There, I know some Apple developers who go to NS Coder Nights and Cocoa Heads meetings in the area. So what Apple could do is, I'm certain there are many Apple engineers who would like to be in the community, but there are limited tickets available even for Apple employees. So not every Apple employee can go to WWDC. But since the party or the show is in town during this week, so Apple could let the other developers go to these other conferences and maybe do a talk there, or maybe do small labs there. And
I
don't think that would detract much from WWDC, but it would be a gesture by Apple saying that they trust a little bit also in something outside of Apple, because Apple's big problem is they don't trust anybody outside of themselves.
Or for example, let 10 engineers go to NS conference and do a talk there and just sponsor them. I mean,
yeah,
that'll be a big help for the whole community.
Yeah, right. A final topic, we've already talked like 1 hour, but I want to briefly kind of brush that. We originally got talking because I kind of was looking into possibilities how I could write programs to run in the cloud in Objective-C. Now, there was this Objective Cloud, which is basically a service by two, I think, is it German guys, where you submit the Objective-C program, and that basically there's a Java adapter, and then it runs with a certain protocol. You have a different opinion related to programming for the cloud.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, because I worked with Microsoft technologies the last few years, I'm quite comfortable with the .NET framework, with the .NET tools, Visual Studio also. And for this regard, I stick to Windows Azure Cloud, but to the Windows Azure Cloud platform, which also has a framework for iOS to integrate iOS apps into the Windows Cloud quite nicely and easily.
But isn't Azure programmed in JavaScript?
It depends. If you write a server component, you usually write it in C sharp. Yes. There is a Windows mobile service for mobile platforms where you can stick easy JavaScript into the. Let's say you upload a file or you do a transmission to. Or send some data to the cloud service, you can pick the data and do some calculation just during the transaction. There are such things you can do with JavaScript if you wish. But you can always stick to C# and write your own REST-based service, for example. That's how we do it.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying Azure is actually a ploy to get people into the Windows ecosystem and learn to program C#?
Well, I mean, the mother tongue of Windows system is C#,
mm-hmm.
and probably remains C# for quite a while. And if you really stick to that platform, you should know C#, which is... As you probably know, is also a C-based language, although different, of course. But
it confuses me a little bit because other podcasts that I'm listening to, when Brent Simmons is on, they say you only need to know JavaScript to use Azure for iOS apps.
If you want to, yeah, there is this Windows mobile service, which is a special edition of this cloud platform,
mm-hmm.
and it's like another layer on top of Windows Azure,
mm-hmm.
and that layer allows you to just do your business logic with JavaScript, but it's quite limited in what you can do. So if you go back or go down a layer and stick to C# and REST services, and then you can you have the freedom to do whatever you want. I mean, then you have the whole platform for you to use.
Well, so I'm still keeping my fingers crossed that someday Apple might give us a possibility to run Objective-C on there. Machines in these big data centers, so that I basically really have Objective-C in the cloud. And I'm not talking about rejuvenating web objects, which are Java. I heard they originally were Objective-C.
It was actually a next technology.
Yeah, but
invented in 1993.
Now it's Java, and as such, I think. I don't like Java. But if there was a possibility, say, that I have my Xcode and I write a little bit of business logic and then I can push that to some container on Apple servers and I have a URL that I can run against that and maybe even get a SQLite database to go with that, then I that would be bliss for me. Yeah, and I'm still hoping that one day Apple will do that.
No. They have web objects. The Objective-C version, taken over to Java in just around 2000. Before it was really just a sole Objective-C framework, And it will be nice to have that framework back on the Mac stack. That's right. I mean, the core data actually came out of the of this object relational database they have, or framework they had before, and it's WebObjects framework itself is actually the rendering engine for HTML template based views.
Yeah. Hey, Tony, it's been a nice 1.5 hours now.
Yeah.
I think
already.
Yeah. We should call it a day.
Yeah. Right.
Anyway, nice talking to you. Thank you for spending the time with me.
No worries.
Where would listeners go to if they wanted to learn more about you and your company?
Well, my company's URL is www.n3xt.com. Or you find me also on Facebook, facebook.com/n3xt.de or EN, depending on the language.
You don't do Twitter?
I'm Tonik173. T-O-N-I-K 173.
All right. And I'm Coconetics. If you have any comments for us to read on the show, or maybe just want to voice your opinion, drop me an email, oliver@coconetics.com. That's been another edition of the Coconetics podcast. I hope you liked it, and will listen to us again when we do another show.